session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, Reel 16. Ted, you mentioned obviously making an attack on that German ship. Firstly, what was the aircraft armed up with? And how is the bomb actually physically released? Who's responsibility for it, and what do you have to press to do that?
I can't honestly remember what the aircraft was armed with on that particular occasion. It would probably be two GP, general purpose, 250-pound bombs, and perhaps two semi-armor-piercing. It varied considerably. I don't know if you want me to be specific about that particular action, but I think it's better to explain it in general terms, in that, first of all, we didn't have depth charges to begin with. We had what were known as anti-submarine bombs, and for the life of me I can't see what real use they were, because for one thing, you know, a 250 bomb isn't really all that large. It's not difficult to imagine them being dropped, and even if the U-boat is on the surface, just simply bouncing down the side and going down into the water. And that probably wouldn't have been sufficient unless they were primed for immediate detonation to do any harm. But they were superseded by depth charges, 250-pound depth charges. So that would be one type that we might be bombed up with. There were general-purpose bombs, which were large splintering explosive, but not with all that much penetrating power apart from the explosive itself. And then there were semi-armor piercing, and then fully armor piercing. Because we didn't know whether we were going to come across ships, much less warships, or U-boats, we would normally have a mixture, two of one kind, two of another. I would say that on that particular attack you mentioned, it would probably be two general purpose and two semi-armor piercing. One had to bear in mind that we, being able to carry 1,000 pounds worth of bombs, which is an insignificant load, really, I don't think we ever expected to be able to sink at one, for one bomb to sink a ship, unless we were very, very lucky, you might say, unless we got it down the funnel, something of that kind, because it may be badly damaged, and that would be part of the success of the strike, of course, because then it would be reported in debriefing, and it would be up to command to decide whether to send out another strike or to try and catch it on the next patrol a little further up or down the coast. Had it been attacked for a second time like that, then probably the bombs would have been semi-armor piercing. It did vary a lot, and sometimes, particularly from Wick, probably the armourers knew what we would drop if we got a chance before we did, because it took some time for the armourers to fit the bombs and that sort of thing before we took off. And we would know what the bombs were, but they would have known before us whether it was likely to be a ship or a U-boat or just a land target.
How do you select those bombs, obviously, if you have a mixture of bombs on board like that?
We had some switches down the right-hand side on a sort of bulkhead down the side, which... had to be depressed, and that released something or other. I'm not very well informed about these things. As long as it worked when we pressed the button, we didn't seem to bother. We certainly didn't have any lessons, you might say, in how bombs are fitted and so on. there was a bomb. I think the bomb. We had to press something on the dashboard, but I think that the bomb dropping mechanism was controlled from a button on the joystick wheel. Anyway, it was just a matter really of two things I remember. One, two, and then drop. And sorry, I'm not very informative about that.
And it was the pilot's responsibility, was it, obviously, to aim at the target and drop the bombs?
Yes.
At this stage, what was your accommodation while you were at Thornaby?
Wooden blocks of single rooms. It was quite nice, actually. Very much better than a large dormitory. There was a very nice mess. Well stocked, because for some time, of course, there was no rationing, didn't come in until sometime in 1940. I wouldn't know exactly when. My mother could tell me, but most of the sergeant's messes, I think, and certainly at Thornaby, which had been more like a home, of course, to the basic regular people there. We had very good meals, not repeated very frequently in other messes. It wasn't as good up at Wick. Other than the fact that we were very friendly with a fisherman down on the quay, who lived down on the quay, and he used to give us, they took us in for meals of fish that was just sort of taken off the boat and into the frying pan. And all that. That was very good. A chap called Robbie, I remember, Robbie.
Was there a bar in the sergeant's mess as well?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, when you had the usual bar bill and so on. That wasn't of first importance to me. I never have been a heavy drinker. I like a glass of Guinness. But there were the usual things there. And we were very, very happy in our own way. As I think I've mentioned, the difference between, for example, a station like Thornaby in a built-up area and Wick out in the wilderness, you might say. But Thornaby was a good station in that respect.
Were you ever detached from the station to fly from other stations?
Yes, we shortly after joining the squadron, actually, in that autumn, the Germans were very quick in beginning to use the ports that they'd captured during the fall of France. And I think I mentioned earlier that the Scharnhorst and the Neisenau, the two German battle cruisers, which had been in the Atlantic sinking our shipping, had gone back into Brest. Brest was becoming a major target. In fact, there's a very good account of what happened to the Blenheim squadrons. I think they were either borrowed from Bomber Command or transferred. Given the job of doing virtually nightly patrols over Brest, dropping the occasional bomb, they lost a lot of Blenheims in doing that, and it's written about in a book called Chasing After Danger, and certainly they were. But our job in being detached to St Neville in Cornwall was to patrol on the French side of the English Channel, and we started the surveillance of Brest, which was kept up by other squadrons, detachments from other squadrons, until that famous dash through the Channel of the battleships. Which unfortunately they managed to succeed in getting through. Seemed a bit of a wasteful time in shadowing them for so long. Now, just sort of off the French coast, where we had to use ASV at night, it was really. Because, of course, it was easy to follow them or to know about what they were doing during the day, but night was a different matter. We were one of the first squadrons to get ASV Mark 1, ASV standing for anti-submarine vessel or anti-surface vessel, as you please. And the poor old ASV operator was glued to his set whilst we did a six and a half hour or thereabouts crossover search in the English Channel or off the coast of Brest within sight of the Akak guns, which probably were having a go at one or more Blenheims, that was quite a different sergeant's mess there, because St Neville had already been heavily bombed by the Germans. In fact, we lost, 220 Squadron lost 20 odd people, ground crew, from a direct hit by a German bomb on a shelter. There were broken windows everywhere. There were various smashed parts of buildings. Some bombs had hit the runways, and they were very quickly repaired in a way. But the trouble that one or two of our lads from 220 had, and others from other squadrons from various times, was the weather. We went down there in November 1940. We were there for 3 weeks, I think. I think we did 3 week stints. I'm glad it wasn't any longer, because the sergeant's mess was quite different to the one at... And we had an air raid during the day. They always seem to send off a Yankers 88 to come across at breakfast time. And they were getting so jittery on the ground that one of the chaps went through a window in order to try and get to the shelter in time. And then after that, it just sort of went back to normal, and we carried on with our breakfast. But the mess was very, compared with Thornaby, a new station like that, not really fully operational yet. It was pretty awful. We were sleeping on five of us. There were married quarters already built, two of them, and we were sleeping on mattresses, straw mattresses, palliasses, on the floor, five in a room. And the weather was what we had to watch. We were lucky when we got caught out on one occasion. Coming back at night, there was a... We discovered the landing lights were not on. The only thing that was on, and it was switched off before we could use it, was the identifying beacon, which was at the junction of the runways, we discovered that there was a German night intruder in the circuit, looking for someone to pop off, and so we said, well, we'll just wait and see whether they put the runway on again, runway lights on again for a short time. But they didn't. I didn't actually see him. I think the gunner and the wireless officers by that time in the Astrodome giving us instructions about where he was. I decided we'd get down as quickly as we could, and fortunately they put the beacon light, the identification beacon light, which is quite a large red light, at the intersection of the runway. So I said, right, we're going down, and we just sort of flopped down and put the landing lights on, managed to pick up the runway. And funny thing this was that this was the end of my 5 hours night flying, which I'd been ordered to do along with every other newish pilot in the squadron in order to qualify for my night flying, my future night flying. I don't know how it came about in this particular way, but I did just over 5 hours manage to get the aircraft down without any lights on the runway, and immediately the beacon light went out and we were safely down. The funny thing was that I couldn't help but hark back to my time at Sidlouth when I'd crashed coming in at night because of the making of the runways there, and the unfortunate remarks that the CO had put in my logbook. I just wished I could have taken it to him then, because I carried out my order actually on operations to get in another 5 hours night flying, and got down in one piece in difficult circumstances. So that's how things work out. One of the coincidences, I think.
You mentioned the weather being a problem. Were there specific weather conditions that you experienced at Centreville?
Well, yes, that was the cause of us losing two aircraft, actually, simply because of the weather and the uncertainty about where Felixstowe... not Felixstowe, of course, I'm...
Falmouth?
I don't know why that... No, where St. Neville was. And the patrols, of course, took us to the south of Cornwall. And with St. Neville being fairly near to Bodmin Moor and the other highland... in that part, in the southwest, that part of the world, it was a bit difficult getting back when there were no aids, and one of the aircraft couldn't get down. This was from another detachment. Couldn't get down, or at least didn't get down until all the petrol had been used up, because they came into the bad weather as they came back off the patrol, and had to crash land on the beach. And a chap called Roggenhagen broke his leg in that. And that's not the case, no. Somebody else was damaged. Roggenhagen broke his leg in having to bail out of a different aircraft doing the same sort of thing, but having to turn back out to sea because they couldn't make any progress over land, and they had to the crew had to bail out, and they lost one poor chap who was drowned.
Could the weather conditions change quite rapidly in Cornwall?
Yes. They do. And particularly at that time of year, in late autumn. It seemed to be a pretty, a peculiarly troublesome time in that respect. We were fortunate during our time there that other patrols that we didn't have any problems from the weather, really.
And you say that the airfield was had been quite smashed about a bit by Germans at that period of time. Mm. Were they specifically targeting that airfield?
Yes. Yes, because that was the closest to Brest, you see. And they knew, obviously, that these Blenheims were flying from St. Neville. And they also knew, of course, that, after a time, that this was an ongoing patrol being undertaken by these Hudsons. And they knew that we were there for 3 weeks at a time, but it was ongoing, and that it was supposed to be, there wasn't supposed to be any time when the ASV or daylight was giving the necessary indication.
Who would operate the ASV in the aircraft? Would it be the wireless operator, or was there an ASV operator?
No, there wasn't a separate operator. It would be the wireless operator. Yeah. And this was the Mark 1, of course, which was pretty useless. You compare it with what developed. Better than nothing, I suppose, but then on the other hand, I don't suppose they would have sent us on the type of evening or night patrol without it. There wasn't much point in, unless it was a starlit night.
But you say it was pretty useless, but I assume it would have been able to pick up something as large as a battleship that stage.
Yes. Yeah. If you're in the right position, the right height.
And what would have happened? What would have been the procedure should you have spotted some movement out of Brest?
And that would depend on the instructions given at briefing, if they wanted to know immediately. If we could identify the type of ship or whatever, they may have instructed us to report during debriefing, or to send a coded message, a simple Q code message might have fitted the situation, or to radio in open code, depending on the urgency that the information was needed, I imagine.
And was emphasis given to this as being a priority, that this was something that needed to be done, as such, that you were looking for these capital ships and that they posed such a threat?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, we lost 150,000 tonnes of shipping simply by being shot at by the Nijnsnam and the Scharnhorst.